African Revolution.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from the not-so-great White North here in Toronto, Canada. And we have an action-packed show for you today. We're going to be paying tribute to Gil Scott-Heron. We're going to be doing some interview with someone that did a book on Gil Scott-Heron. We just heard Madison Avenue by Gil Scott-Heron. And we're going to be speaking with Heather Augustine at 3:30 about a great book on a pioneer women in Jamaican music. And we're also going to be speaking to someone at 2:30 about Gil Scott-Heron. And we have a lot of great music from women from Jamaica performing various genres of music. But we would like to thank two people like we do every week. First of all, we would like to thank Chairman Omali Ishetela, the chair of the African People's Socialist Party and the chair of the African Socialist International, for giving us the space on Uhuru Radio to provide you with the Diasporic Music every week. And we would also like to thank Archie Shepp, a young man who was one of my mentors, who gave me the concept of diasporic music. Music made in the West, but not of the West, but we cheat. We play music from the continent of Africa, from Europe, from the South Pacific, and wherever African people may be. And we have some great shows on diasporic music. We have some great shows on Uhuru Radio. Diasporic Music is one of the great shows. I can't say whether or not Diasporic Music is a great show. That is for the people to determine that. But Uhuru Radio has Omali Ishatella Speaks. We have Africa Live, which is hosted by Didon Sankara. We have Reparations in Action, which is hosted by Penny Hess. We have Revolutionary Health and Fitness, John Thomas. Ron Bob Simple is on twice. He's so nice. He's on twice with Golden Sunday Sounds and Caribbean Forum. We also have a Black Agenda Report with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey. We also have a show called Great Moments in African History. We also have a report from Africans in Sweden and throughout Europe. And we also have a show called Common Ground. And we want to continue our tribute to Gil Scott-Heron. And Gil Scott-Heron is a very controversial human being. And we're going to play some music from our brother, Gil Scott-Heron.
My lifetime, I've been in times where there was no freedom or a future around. I've been in places where you could not eat or take a drink of water wherever you please. And now that I meet you, got me to the middle of
lights that shine on, inspire me to climb on from all of the places we've been, from all of the places we've been, from all of the places we've been, a lot of places, yeah, from all of the places we've been.
Questions.
What's that?
For their mothers as they ran. But no one stopped to think about the babies or how they would survive. And we were almost lost Detroit this time. Get over losing our minds. Just 30 miles from Detroit stands a giant power station. Ticks each night as the city sleeps, seconds from annihilation. But no one stopped to think about the people or how they would survive. And we almost lost Detroit this time. How would we ever get over losing our mind? The sheriff of Monroe County had a show enough disasters on his mind. And what would Karen Silkwood say to you if she was still alive? That when it comes to people's safety, money wins out every time. Detroit, that time, almost lost Detroit, that time, how will we ever get over, the odds are we're gonna lose somewhere, one time. We're gonna lose somewhere, sometime.
seen the leaves turn to golden brown. I've seen the red sun in the autumn, and I've seen the leaves be turning to golden brown. I've seen the red blood of my people, heard them calling for freedom everywhere. If you've seen the red blood of your people, all you've got to do is reach out your hand and we'll take you there. Red stands for liberation. Red, red, yeah. My homeland.
To stand for a brand new nation. Yeah.
Nanga Def to all of the Wolof speakers in Senegal, the Gambia, Mauritania, and all over the earth. And we are paying tribute to Gil Scott-Heron. We're getting ready to do an interview with Marcus Broham and Brahm, pardon me, Marcus Brahm. He did a book on Gil Scott-Heron called Pieces of a Man, and we're going to be speaking with him. But we heard the liberation song, The Red, Black, and Green. We also heard We Almost Lost Detroit, and he wasn't talking about an urban rebellion or so-called race riot. He was talking about that song is about the environment. And we also heard 95 South, all of the places we've been. And we're going to be speaking with Marcus Brahm after we play Message to the Messenger. And stay tuned for our interview with Marcus Brahm.
Hey, yeah, we're the same brothers from a long time ago. We was talking about television and doing it on the radio. What we did was to help our generation realize they got to get out there and get busy because it wasn't going to be televised. We got respect for young rappers and the way they're freewaying. But if you're going to be teaching folks things, be sure you know what you're saying. Older folks in our neighborhood got plenty of know-how. And remember, if it wasn't for them, you wouldn't be out there now. And I ain't coming at you with no disrespect. All I'm saying is that you damn well got to be correct. Because if you're going to be speaking for a whole generation, and you know enough to try and handle their education, be sure you know the real deal about past situations and ain't just repeating what you heard on a local TV station. Sometimes they tell lies and put them in a truthful disguise. But the truth is, that's why we said it wouldn't be televised. They don't know what to say to our young folks, but they know that you do. And if they really knew the truth, why would they tell you? The first sign is peace. Tell all them gun-toting young brothers that the man is glad to see us out there killing one another. We raised too much hell when they were shooting us down, so they started poisoning our minds and trying to jerk us all around. And then they tell us they got to come in and control our situation. They want half of us on dope and the other half in incarceration. If the ones they want dead ain't killed by what they instigated, they can put some dope on the brother's body and claim it was drug-related. Tell them drug-related means there don't need to be no investigation, or at least that's the way they're gonna play it on the local TV station. All your 9mm brothers, give them something to think about. Tell them you heard that this is the new word. They got to work that stuff out. Because somehow they're feeling the wrong way with a gun in their hands. They're feeling real independent, but they just pulling contracts with a man. 5 and 5 will tell you it's hopeless out there on the avenue, but if they really knew the truth, why would they tell you? And if they look at you like you're insane and they start calling you scarecrow and say you ain't got no brain, or start telling folks that you suddenly gone lame, or that white folks have finally co-opted your game, or worse yet, implying that you don't really know, that's the same thing they said about us a long time ago. Young rappers, one more suggestion before I get out of your way. But I appreciate the respect you give me and what you got to say. I'm saying protect your community and spread that respect around. Tell brothers and sisters they got to calm that bullshit down. Because we're terrorizing our old folks and we brought fear into our homes. And they ain't got to hang out with the senior citizens. Just tell them, damn it, leave the old folks alone. And we know who's ripping off the neighborhood. Tell them that BS has got to stop. Tell them you're sorry they can't handle it out there, but they got to take the crime off the block. And if they look at you like they think you're insane, or start calling you scarecrow thinking you ain't got no brain, or start telling folks that you suddenly gone lame, or that white folks have suddenly co-opted your game, or worse yet, saying that you really don't know, that's the same thing they said about me a long time ago. And if they tell folks that you finally lost your nerve, that's the same thing they said about us when we said Johannesburg. But I think you young folks need to know that things don't go both ways. You can't talk respect on every other song or just every other day. What I'm speaking on now is the raps about the women folks. On one song, she's your African queen, and on the next one, she's a joke. And you ain't said no words that I haven't heard, but that ain't no compliment. It only insults 8 people out of 10 and questions your intelligence. 4-letter words or 4-syllable words won't make you a poet. It will only magnify how shallow you are and let everybody know it. And if they look at you like they think you're insane, or they call you scarecrow thinking you ain't got no brain, or start telling folks that you suddenly gone lame, or that the white folks have finally co-opted your game, or you really don't know, they said that about me a long time ago. If they finally start telling people that you lost your nerve, that's what they said about Johannesburg. You ain't insane, you have got a brain, you haven't gone lame, you have got your game. Remember, keep the nerve, keep the nerve, keep the nerve, keep the nerve. We're talking about peace.
Yuhuru, I am Mayembe Malaika. I support Burning Spear Media and Norman Otis Richmond. Will you? Burning Spear Media keeps alive African culture from North America, the Caribbean, Africa, and the world. We have not forgotten Patrice Emery Lumumba, Joseph Okito, and Maurice Mbolo. Burning Spear Media keeps them alive. Uhuru News and Radio connects African people worldwide. Burning Spear Media is owned and controlled by the African working class. Yes, bless you.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and we are paying tribute to Gil Scott-Heron. We just heard Message to the Messengers, and there is a brand new book out about Gil Scott-Heron called Pieces of a Man by Marcus Baram, and he is on the line with me, and he is a managing editor of International Business Times and a former news editor at the New York Observer. And how are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm good. Thanks for having me here.
I am very interested in this book, and I'm interested in, I think you actually, I guess for full disclosure, you actually interviewed me among millions of other people for this book, and also did you ever get a chance to talk to Uncle Roy Heron, or you just quoted him?
You know, I didn't. I didn't get a chance because Roy, Gil's Uncle Roy Heron, is now, when I finally was able to reach out to his children, I was told he was in this nursing home, and he wasn't really able to talk much. He wasn't like in the best shape, so unfortunately I didn't get a chance to talk to Roy.
All right, now go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, you were among about 200 people I interviewed, from most of Gil's family going back several generations to almost all the band members he played with over the years, and friends and colleagues and fellow musicians and studio executives and journalists. And so it was a very wide array of people who are part of Gil's world.
So why would you want to write about Gil Scott-Heron?
Yeah, good question. I always get that. I'm a journalist, but I pretty much cover usually hard news, sort of financial news and politics and investigative reporting. And I never write about music. I love music, but I never write about it because I think it's hard to write about. It's hard to express, you know, what music can mean for you. But with Gil, it was really a long time, a dream of mine to write about him. I was a big fan in college in the 1980s. And then when I first started to see him live in New York, I got to know him a little bit backstage. I remember the very first show, I was overwhelmed by the power of his performance and the music and the message in the music. And just thinking to myself, you know, there's dozens of books every year that come out about the Beatles and Bob Dylan and the jazz greats and Woody Guthrie, and there's nothing on Gil. And he deserves a book. And someone has to pay tribute to his genius, his legacy, the power of his music. And I was a school teacher back then. I wasn't even a journalist. But I remember thinking to myself, you know, I'm going to write a book someday. This is like early 90s. And then I always had it in the back of my mind. And I met Gil backstage, and I profiled him for New York Magazine in 2008. We hung out for a while. And then when he passed, right away, I was like, I got to do it now. I got to do the tribute to Gil. More as a labor of love. But I'm a reporter, and so I can't help reporting and digging and talking to as many people as I can. And that's, I really wanted to get Gil's music out there and his life story.
And how has the public reacted and responded to the book in terms of, was it a hard sell for St. Martin's, or was that the first publisher you went to, or was it
Yeah, good question. I got very lucky. I was, for a long time, I kind of held back because I'd heard stories about publishing and how you have to write, you know, a 30 or 40 page proposal, which takes a lot of work, and then they might turn it down. And I kind of didn't expect much, but then I got lucky. I met an agent who, Sarah Lazen, who represents a lot of music writers. The day I met her, she was like, I just got a phone call from somebody at St. Martin's Press who's looking for, asking if anybody I have that could write the Gil Scott Heron book. And I was like, well, I'm your man. It was like it was a perfect, you know, coincidence. So I wrote like a 3-page kind of synopsis of why I was the best person to write the book, and met with the editor at St. Martin's, and she made me a deal right away. So I was very lucky because I really didn't expect that. I thought it would be hard to find like a major publisher because, you know, it's a, unfortunately, you know, Gil is not the most known musician, not doesn't have the fame maybe he did in the 70s. So I thought it would be a little difficult, but I was lucky. And I've also been blessed with a lot of great, you know, attention. I mean, even before the book came out, I had excerpts in Vanity Fair, which is obviously more focused on celebrities and Hollywood, but they did a big excerpt. Newsweek, The Daily Beast did a big excerpt. So I've really been blessed with a lot of good publicity and attention, and, you know, doing interviews with you and others has been wonderful.
I'm speaking with Marcus Rahm, and my name is Norman Richmond. This is Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. Now, Gil Scott Heron, I met Gil Scott Heron in 1976, just before the Montreal Olympics, and I remember he was very, very good with words, and I remember I asked him the question. He was singing how, you know, he was talking about his, you know, his history and how they used to sing Get Ready. And I remember I asked him, I said, did you sing falsetto? He laughed. Mm-hmm. He looked at me. It was a room full of people and says, you know, I didn't sing false anything, you know.
Gil, his wit.
Then I asked him about what he thought about George Clinton. And everybody was looking and laughing. And he says, oh, you mean I want the funk, give up you. Oh, you mean the guy with the diaper? You see, he likes to do the bump. See, I don't know what his politics are, but, you know, he likes to do the bump. So, I mean, he had a field day. Everybody was laughing at me.
Yeah. That's hilarious. That was Gil. He loved just, he couldn't help but just being witty and sarcastic and just having fun with the circus of politics. So.
And while that was going on, Kwame Ture walks into the room, Stokely Carmichael, and he had just come back from McDonald's, and he told the people that he was an organizer and he had to eat. So, of course, they jumped on him about his diet, you know. And
right. I put in the book. I put that in the book, your recording of that moment. So I thank you for that.
Now, Gil Scott-Heron's mother does not really get a lot of attention, his mother and his grandmother. You know, when I met him, like, one of the things I remember you put in the book was, you know, Aristat put out the fact that his father was a Gil Heron, who was a great soccer player, and the Black Arrow, so on and so forth. He had an article in Ebony magazine in, I guess, 1948. But when I mentioned Gil's father, he flipped out on me, and he said he made the point how the Scots had raised him. Could you talk about his grandmother and his mother, and his family background, the people the Scott side of the family and the people that raised him, then we can talk about the Heron side.
Sure. I mean, essentially, I mean, he might have reacted that way because basically Gil was kind of abandoned by, especially his father. So his father, who was, many ways the Jackie Robinson of professional soccer, even before Jackie Robinson broke the color line, Gil Heron did that with soccer. But he got an opportunity to play for Celtic, the big Scottish soccer powerhouse, and left, basically abandoned Gil after he'd just been born in 49-50. And then his mother had a hard time kind of raising him on her own, and she, was ambitious and had career plans. So she left Gil with her mother in Jackson, Tennessee, the small, sleepy town down south. And Gil was essentially raised by his grandmother, Lily, who was a larger-than-life personality. She was a small, short woman, barely 5 feet tall, her hair tied back. But she was a very proud woman, a lot of integrity. And he learned, I think, a lot from his grandmother. He always said, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything, which was something his grandmother had said to him. And that was probably the quote he recycled the most. He never stopped, had a chance, never, skipped the chance to just repeat that quote, just to show that the kind of sense of pride and integrity that his grandmother gave him, because she's the one who really raised him. And her, like a little bit of her extended family down in Jackson, her cousins and neighbors and friends, really raised Gil until he was, 11, and when his grandmother died, and then his mother came down to basically take over. But he really, in many ways was kind of abandoned by his mother and father, and then, until his mother kind of had to come down and take care of him again, and then they developed a special bond. His mother was very smart, very witty, the librarian, and was had her own artistic ambitions, and she, he'd often talk to her about lyrics. She supplied, like, the kicker and the Whitey on the Moon. I'm going to send these Dr. Bill's airmail special to Whitey on the Moon. That was came from his mother, Bobby, who was a very creative and witty person. And the two of them would kind of bounce ideas off each other. And he got a lot of his sarcasm and wit from his mother, Bobby. I mean, he was very close to her. And when she died, it was in the 90s, it was pretty devastating for Gil.
Let me cut you. I want you to return to that thought, but could you give us a background of in terms of all of his aunts and uncles graduated from college, whereas his grandmother, I don't know if she finished school, but she was really literate in the sense that she read the Black newspapers, she read the Bible, and so on and so forth. But all of his aunts and uncles were college graduates. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, definitely. His grandmother Lily, who raised him, and her husband, Bob, they were not themselves, educated, they didn't go to college, but they were very proud, hardworking individuals, and they made sure that their four children, the one son, William, and the three daughters, including Bobby Gill's mother, were, you know, took education seriously. They really emphasized that in the house. And so all four children went on to college, which at that time, you know, was an achievement in the 1940s and in a southern town like Jackson to have four black children go on to college. And they all, you know, accomplished a lot. And, you know, Gil's aunt Gloria ended up basically traveling the world doing work for the government. And she'd sent letters from Cuba and from Africa and from parts of Europe and Italy and the Ukraine. And it was just, they really had a, they accomplished a lot. And his mother too, in her own way, became a, you know, a top librarian and then worked in New York for the housing authority. They were in that. I mean, I was always instilled in Gil. And so I think there was nobody who couldn't go to college. And when Gil did drop out to write The Vulture, his first novel, he was very, very, it was a challenge to convince his mother that was a good idea. Because he knew that wouldn't fly. And he really, you know, she accepted it, but with understanding that he would go back to college as soon as he finished.
Right, right. Right.
Which he did. So there was, you know, there was a lot of pressure to go to college and get educated. And Gil did that. And I think when Gil got his master's degree and went to Johns Hopkins, he couldn't wait to show his mother, you know, that he had that accomplishment, because he knew she'd be proud.
I'm speaking with Marcus Brum, the author of a brand new book about Gil Scott-Heron, a biography of Gil Scott-Heron called Pieces of a Man. And I remember I saw Gil Scott-Heron in 1981 when he performed with Stevie Wonder. He replaced Bob Marley. Bob Marley became ill, and Stevie took Gil with him instead of Bob. And I understand there was a big conflict with Motown. Didn't want Gil. They wanted someone bigger. But Stevie said he wanted Gil, but I remember when I was backstage and I saw this guy, long, looked just like Gil, but he was lighter, but he had these, well, I looked at his arms, he had these long arms. I said, that's Gil's brother. I said, that's Gil's brother. And it turned out to be Dennis. Could you talk about, the role that Dennis played with Gil?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Dennis, it was a half-brother, Gil, because basically his father came back from Scotland and lived in Detroit and married a white Scottish woman and had children. And Gil, they didn't know about Gil at all until I think one of the daughters found out, had heard the bottle or something and saw the name and was like, oh, my God, that somebody were related to, and she confronted their father. And he said, yeah, you know, I had a son. And because he, you know. And so when Gil came to perform in Detroit in 76, his half-sister kind of surprised him. And then through that, Gil met his half-brother, Dennis, who was a little bit younger at the time. And then later, Gil invited Dennis to kind of join them on tour. They really hit it off. And they looked very similar, and similar politics, and they really bonded, and it was a rediscovery. You know, Dennis never knew he had this older brother, and for Gil, he never had a brother or sister, so it was, for him, it was a thrill. And Dennis, you know, joined the band, and then was a manager of the band for a long time, until like the early 80s, and they had like a special connection. But then I think once Gil's drug problems started to mount, and he was spending a lot of money for gigs on cocaine and drugs, it was just too much, and Dennis just he left, and he couldn't keep dealing with Gil's problems. And then they kept in touch, and they reunited years later in New York, and they saw each other often in New York in the 90s when Gil lived there, and then Dennis came to live in New York. And Dennis is one of the managers of Symphony Space now, which is one of the main venues in New York City. And he's a great guy.
Now, you know, the whole question of the dependence on drugs and alcohol and, you know, struggling with depression. I remember I was in I passed through Holland in 1992, and I think that was the centenary of Van Gogh's birth. And, I mean, he was a genius. Could you talk about I maintain that Gil was such a genius that he really couldn't cope with what was going on because he was so far ahead of all of us, including myself, in terms of how he saw the world.
And, yeah. You know, I totally agree. Yeah, and I agree. I mean, that's one question I always get from people is what happened? And here you have this, he was so intelligent and aware, and he was singing about the dangers of drug addiction. And, you know, almost where the hatred is, obviously the bottle with alcoholism, and angel dust and other songs. How could he himself, you know, fall prey to that? And I think a lot of that, just what you pointed to, was was one of the reasons was that there was a lot of pressure on him. You know, it's hard when you're an artist, I think, because you have all kinds of ideas and you can't always execute, and you have to make, you're at the whim of the studio system and making records, and there was pressure on the music side for him to produce hits and to have his album sell well. And Gil wanted to make his kind of music and not compromise and bring in R&B producers, and, you know, the slick sound of the 80s. And there was also pressure from the activist community because Gil was so vocal and such a, you know, influential figure. He was getting pressure from whether it was the Black Panthers in the early 70s or later protest movements to have Gil become their, you know, their prince, their spokesman, and to tell them what was happening in the community. And the pressure from that was intense too, because sometimes Gil didn't care. Sometimes, like I said in the book, all he wanted to do was read a Sports Illustrated magazine and, you know, see what was happening with the Mets and just watch a baseball game. He didn't always want to be like the, you know, 24/7 activist who was out in the streets with a protest sign. That, you know, he loved, he had a passion for that, but it wasn't all of him. And so the pressures of that combined with his own, I think, from being abandoned as a child, he had a hard time opening up to people emotionally. He put a lot of it into his lyrics, obviously. But even with, you know, his wife and that was close to him, he had a hard time, I think, opening up about his deepest fears and the pressure that he was experiencing. And so he had to sought an escape for him. But, you know, like a lot of musicians at the time was, you know, doing some drugs. And then because of his own physical constitution, that ended up becoming an addiction. Some people can get over that and give up drugs, and some people can't. You know, it's just, it's in the biology that I developed an addiction. I think that's happened with Gil. So that really became well for many years.
You are definitely beginning to crack. I don't know, but we're going to continue trooping on. I remember 1981. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? You're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond. Marcus Brahm, can you hear me?
I can hear you now, yeah. I can hear you.
Oh, okay. Now I'm saying in 1981, he introduced me to his wife, at the Brenda. Time, Brenda Sykes. And, you know, I was to find out later that Brenda Sykes' cousin married my Uncle Prentice. And I used to tease Gil. I used to say, okay, now we're cousins. And his relationship with his daughter. Could you talk about how is his daughter by Brenda doing right now? I think she's a spoken word artist as well, correct?
Yes. His daughter Gia by Brenda is a spoken word. I mean, basically following in Gil's footsteps. She does spoken word poetry. She went to college in California, outside of LA, and that's what she does now. She performs kind of performance, you know, venues and jazz clubs and coffee shops in L.A. and does her own poetry. And it's quite good. She's really quite good. And they had any, they, you know, Gil, he really, really loved Brenda. There was a special relationship. And I think he, you know, when the drug problems started to mount and he was on tour and career problems, he kind of, the marriage just couldn't survive that. But, you know, he kept in touch with Brenda, always loved her, and she loved him. And, you know, he would try to come back and see his daughter when he could. And at the end of his life, they kind of reunited in some ways after a bit of an absence. And kind of Gia hung out with him a few times on tour when Gil had the revival at the end of his career with the I'm New Here album. And so at the end of, you know, his life, they were close.
We have about 8 minutes left. Is there anything you would like to add that I haven't, that your special thoughts on Gil Scott here?
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I always like to emphasize is that this, you know, he's such a unique example. Like, you can't think of anyone today who is a Scott Heron in terms of the power of art. Somebody who takes, they're observing what's happening in the society around them, in the politics, in issues affecting the community, and make art that speaks to that, and then spreads that through concerts and through albums, and then even intercut their, you know, songs with monologues and the discussions. And I mean, Joe used to go around, even without the band, on his own in the 70s to college campuses and just talk to like a few dozen students and perform on piano and do a few songs. And then they'd talk and discuss the issues, whether it was the FBI surveillance of artists in the early 70s or whether it was environmental dangers in the community. And there's very few artists who do that today. And I think he shows that you don't have to sell out. For an artist to hit it big, and to, especially in music, you can have integrity to make it. You can, you know, stick to your principles and stick to the kind of music you make, and you can succeed if you really are committed to it. If you find an audience and you build a community, you don't have to sell out and sell out your principles. And Gil, that was, I think, that's really the message of his, that's his legacy. Think in many ways, and it's hard. Obviously, now the music industry is very difficult to succeed in, and it's all these, you know, seem to be computer generated rhythms for, you know, models who get plucked by the studios to represent. But you can do it, I think, if you really are committed and persistent. And that's really the message of what Gil was trying to do.
When was the last time you saw Gil?
I saw him just, I talk about it, I think, in the book, but it was, I think, in 2010. He did a gig, and he was at Central Park in the summer stage. I saw him there, and then I think around the same time, I also saw him at SOB's, which was the venue he always picked in New York to perform at.
Right.
And doing his I'm New Here album, you know, he'd come back, and that was critically praised, and he had really was like riding a wave. He was like riding a surge of interest in his music after a long, long absence. So it was really gratifying to see that. And they were talking about another album, and his music was already being sampled by Kanye and Common and other hip hop stars. So it was a good time for him. But, you know, he was also, you could tell he was really getting weak. You know, he was so thin. And you could tell he wasn't well.
Well, you know, I will always remember first artist I ever saw in my life, or I remember seeing. My mother tells me she took me to see a whole lot of people, including Duke Ellington. I don't remember that, but I do remember seeing Bobby Green when I was 9 years old, and I do remember Gil Scott Heron recording "I'll Take Care of You" in a beat sampled by Drake, who also has a Tennessee background. Drake and Rihanna out of Rihanna is Barbados, I guess, Barbados and Guyana's roots. But, you know, I remember Gil Scott hearing Loving the Blues, and he called himself a bluesologist, and I called myself a bluesologist. I think the blues, I think Boots Riley of the Coup considers himself a bluesologist as well, you know. But do you think, last question, do you think that African-American music and is African people in the United States are moving away from the blues, or is blues always going to be there?
You know, a good question, very good question. I think blues will always be there. You know, I mean, you'll do find all kinds of variations, and now with, you know, current hip-hop and dance music, things are moving in all kinds of directions. But when you get down to it, the basics of it, a lot of it is blues. And whether you have, like a modern day, there's a lot of blues artists who are kind of rediscovering the old music, and they're kind of roots musicians. Or whether you have even like Lil Wayne, as somebody who's using, you know, computer-generated rhythms, a lot of that is based on the simple blues chords. And it's not the music, at least a lot of the spirit. There's a lot of, you know, Kendrick Lamar and a lot of current hip-hop that definitely speaks to, you know, it addresses issues that the blues did, from things happening in the streets and things happening around you in society. You know, from you have Mos Def and Common and Kendrick and others who are definitely addressing those issues, and Kanye on his own way, who are moving it forward. So it's, I think it'll always be there. Just that you might not recognize it right away.
All right, like let me let you go, and I appreciate this time you spent with us, and we should definitely stay in touch and bring you back and talk more about Gil Scott Heron and what in the state of the music.
Definitely. Well, thank you for having me on. Really, I keep playing the music, and like Joe said, work for peace.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Definitely. Thank you, Norman. It's a real
all
pleasure.
Right. Bye-bye. And I've been speaking with Marcus Ram, and Diasport Music continues on Uhuru Radio.
You're listening to uhururadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution. Information, ideas, reality. That's what the Burning Spear newspaper offers you each month. Truth about government, society, entertainment, and the world around you. The Burning Spear is the oldest Black Power newspaper in existence, and your one-year subscription is only $25. Get the insight and perspective that the mass media machine cannot and will not deliver. Read dynamic articles on the most pressing issues affecting the lives of African workers in the U.S., Africa, and around the world. Each month, you'll find real political analysis of the crisis of parasitic capitalism, insight into world and local events, and a focus on the realities and struggles in the heart of the hood, expressing the vision and voice of the African working class. Uncompromising truth, unwavering focus. The Burning Spear newspaper. This is Black Power in the 21st century. Subscribe today and don't get fooled again. Order your subscription now. Go to burningspearmarketplace.com and click on Spear. That's burningspearmarketplace.com and click on Spear. Uhuru.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasport Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, the bluesologist, coming to you from the Great White North here in Toronto, Canada. And pardon me, I'm still fighting a cold, but we're getting ready to play some music from our sisters from Jamaica. We're going to be speaking with Heather Augustine at 3:30, and we're going to be playing some great music from our sisters from the beautiful island of Jamaica. And right now, let's listen to Sheila Hilton, and she's going to do a song that was produced by Sly and Robbie, but it was written by one of the police Sting, and I don't know whether or not he works for the state or not, but he is works with the musical group The Police, and this is Sheila Hilton. Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. We are paying tribute to some of the pioneers of music in Jamaica. We're going to be speaking with Heather Augustine at 3:30, and we just heard from Sheila Hilton, a song that was produced and arranged by Sly Dunbar and Robbie Shakespeare, two dear friends of mine, and we're going to be listening to the music of Millie Small, Mourna Haig, Bob Andy, Marcia Griffiths, the I-3s, and the I-3s are Marcia Griffiths, Judy Mowat and Rita Marley, Judy Mowat and Rita Marley. And we're going to be listening to Althea and Donna. And then we're going to come back and talk. This is Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio.
I love you. drifting on black. Oh, what a lovely, precious dream.
checks, say we hip and ting. Show them the know and ting. We have them going and ting. Now pop no style, all strictly roots. Now pop no style, all strictly roots. See me on the road and you no call out to me. Do you see me in my pants and ting? See me in my altar back. Send me give your heart attack. Give me little bass, make me wine out my waist. Uptown top ranking. See me in my Benz and ting. Dolly true constant spring. Them checks say we come from Cosmo Spring. But the true them no know and ting. Them no know say we top ranking. Uptown top ranking. Should I see me and the ranking dread? Check out we jamming and ting. Love is all I bring. In a McCarthy suit and ting. Now pop no style. I strictly roots. Now pop no style. We chuck it and ting. In our khaki suit and ting. Love is all I bring. In our khaki suit and ting. Now pop no style. A strictly roots. Now pop no style. A strictly roots.
Ni hao to all of our listeners in Beijing and Shanghai and all of the Chinese listeners in the Chinese diaspora all over the world. And we are paying tribute to the songbirds, the pioneering women in Jamaican music. And we're getting ready to flip the script and play some. Song is called No More Blues, but it's based around some Brazilian music, and it's from Carmen McRae, and Carmen McRae was born in Harlem. Her father was originally from Costa Rica, and her mother was from Jamaica, and I had the pleasure of meeting Carmen McRae one time at the Massey Hall in Toronto, Canada, and let me tell you that Ms. McRae, she could put some words together. I mean, she was maybe second only to Peter Tosh or Fela when it came to using some of the language that African people and other people use, some curse words. But I love Carmen McRae, and I hope you do too. So we're going to listen to Carmen McRae and some Calypso Rose, and come back and speak with Heather Augustine.
Thank you. That song was written by Antonio Carlos Jobim, as is this next one coming up, which is called No More Blues. No more blues. I'm going back home. No more blues, I promise. No more to roam. Home is where the heart is. The funny part is, my heart's been right there all along. No more fears and no more sighs. No more tears, I've said my last goodbyes. If trouble beckons me, I swear I'm gonna refuse. I'm gonna settle down and there'll be no more blues. Every day when I am far away, turn homeward, forever homeward. I've traveled around this world in search of happiness, but all the happiness I found was in my hometown. No more blues, I'm going back home. No more blues, I'm through with all my wanderings. Now I'll settle down, never roam. Find a man and make a home. When we settle down, there'll be no more blues. Nothing but happiness when we settle down. There'll be no more blues. Find a man, make a home. When we settle down, there'll be no more blues. Nothing but happiness when we settle down. When we settle down, we are gonna settle down, baby. I don't want no blues. Hey, you can have them, I don't want them. I'm trying to lose them. No, 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 no.
Like somebody crying, I just couldn't imagine what was happening.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada. And we were listening to the music of Calypso Rose. And prior to Calypso Rose, we heard from Carmen McRae, a woman that could stand toe-to-toe with Peter Tosh or Fela when it comes to using spicy language. And joining us on the line is Heather Augustine, the author of Songbirds, Pioneering Women in Jamaican Music. Ms. Augustine, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much for having me.
Now, we just played Calypso Rose, and Calypso Rose was born in Trinidad and Tobago. Something makes me think Tobago, but you know, I might have Oh yes, she's from Tobago, which is the sister island of Trinidad. But you know, what relationship did Calypso Rose have to Jamaican music?
Well, actually, you're right. She was born in Tobago, and then when she was 8, she went to Trinidad and was raised there by her aunt. But her music was always very popular in Jamaica because, of course, all of the Caribbean islands had plenty of musical cross-pollination. And there were a number of musicians who covered Calypso Rose's music. And Calypso Rose herself even traveled to Jamaica from time to time to perform. So there was the Calypso music that Calypso Rose was performing as a woman was respected by some of her female counterparts in Jamaica, like Millicent Patsy Todd, and they kind of, you know, admired her for what she was doing and decided to do their own take on her songs.
Now, you maintain that the Jamaican women had it very difficult when it come to recording. And I'm definitely not trying to start a debate, but I think the first women to record, or the first people to record in the United States were Trinidadian artists. I don't know if they were men or women, but it was Trinidad. Calypso was recorded before R&B, not R&B. There was no R&B at that time, but blues or jazz. And then in Calypso, the Calypso music was recorded first. And then the in African American music, women recorded before men. But you maintain that the women had a hard time in Jamaican music. Could you expound upon that?
Sure. Well, I guess I don't look at Calypso too much, although kind of as a precursor to the music that became popular in Jamaica later. Calypso, there weren't really very many female artists. There were a few like Calypso Rose, and there were maybe a couple of others from time to time, that like Lady Ayer, and she was kind of part of a duo with her husband, who was Lord Ayer. There were a couple of them, Lady Trinidad being another, but really it was Calypso was largely kind of a men's genre because of the bawdiness of the content of the lyrics. It wasn't really proper for a female to be singing about such bawdiness in the days of the 1930s and the 1940s.
Right.
So it was difficult for women to find their place and their niche, and certainly Calypso Rose did that, and she didn't. She did it in her own way. She didn't stoop down to slackness, as we would say today. She did it in her own way and sung about the topics that she thought were important, some of her lyrics being political in nature. But then specifically in Jamaica, which is what I look at, is the musical climate for women during the 1940s, say, was there was a large place for women in jazz as a jazz vocalist, but women musicians, there weren't too many of them. And mm-hmm. so we did have jazz vocalists like Toetlin Jackson. She certainly had a successful career. But when I take a look at Janet Enright as one of the very first Jamaican musicians, and she kind of had a tough time, but because she came from a life of privilege, she was able to have kind of the proper introduction, where literally the prime ministers were making room for her on the stage and inviting her to their, you know, dinners and their soirees. And so she played guitar, and she would play on the stage surrounded by, flanked by men. And so she never really had difficulty because she was able to give, you know, be able to have that kind of entree into the world of music that many other women, because they weren't privileged, had to fight for. Now, that's not to say that Janet didn't have to fight for her position. She definitely had to prove herself with her talent, because the men were, you know, skeptical of her at first, but then they embraced her once they saw that this, what I call her, she was a little giant. That was what she was nicknamed, Little Giant. Once she proved herself, then she was treated fairly well. But certainly these women were a minority, not the, you know, they, music as an occupation was not really an option for women in these days.
Right.
They were more the traditional roles in the 1940s and the 1950s.
Well, let me say that the African-American women were exploited, probably paid less than the men, and they weren't really promoted. And I think that I don't want to give the impression that the women were doing well in the corporate world because, you know, the capitalism is in the beginning and still is a man's thing, but some of the capitalists say that if they can, they might sell their mama, like Richard Pryor said, you know, if it's about the money, but they can adapt.
Right.
But I wanted to fast forward to Millie Small. Now, Millie Small is you talk about her and My Boy Lollipop, and then another thing I guess we have to really deal with is the fact that there's always been a European man behind black artists, be they male or female, with the exception of Ray Charles, you know. But you know, Louis Armstrong had a white manager, Duke Ellington had a white manager, and Chris Blackwell, I guess, helped Millie Small. But let's talk about Millie Small and My Boy Lollipop.
Okay, all right, that sounds good. Yeah, she certainly, she had established, well, she started to establish her musical career before Chris Blackwell, so, and she had made her mark on a very popular Kingston stage show called the Veer Johns Opportunity Hour, and she kind of made her mark there, and she won second prize in this show. This was kind of a version. There was the show in Kingston, and then it was also replicated in Montego Bay, so she actually won the show in Montego Bay. But after that, she caught the attention of some of the record producers, and when she came to move to Kingston, then she made a couple of tunes, like many women did back in these days, as part of a duo. So she was a vocalist with Owen Gray and Roy Panton, and so that's how many women recorded. They were infrequently the woman in the front.
Right.
So duet, yes, duets was really very popular. And so she was part of the duo that became Roy and Millie. Roy Panton lives up in Canada these days and was extremely helpful with my book. He is married to his duo partner today, Yvonne Harrison. So Roy and Yvonne are now married. But his original duo partner, Millie Small, then she got the opportunity after making quite a few songs with these duos to go to England with Chris Blackwell. She caught his eye. And Chris Blackwell heard her voice. It was extremely unique. And so he said, I've got to get that voice. That voice is going to be a hit. And so he immediately invited her to England. She was 15 years old at this point. And so Blackwell had to go through all kinds of hoops in order to get her up to England, namely getting the permission of her parents. And he had to basically refine her skills to fit the English market, meaning teach her to dance, teach her to dress, get rid of that Jamaican patois. So they sent her to school to teach her, you know, to speak without a thick Jamaican accent and how to dance and how to, you know, be coy to the camera and how to get her hair done and all these sorts of things. So they really did groom her into becoming a young starlet. And her song was a huge hit. My Boy Lollipop is one of the few, if people don't know ska, that's one of the songs that they know, that they say, oh, yeah, that's ska. So people that maybe aren't familiar with the music even know Millie. She was a huge hit and helped Chris Blackwell to launch his record label, Island Records. He was her first hit, even though she wasn't on Island Records, because he actually released the song on a different label because he knew the song was going to be so popular, he didn't want it to swamp his label before he had a chance to make all of the records. But that was the song that launched his record label, Island Records. And so then, of course, he went on to you know, record Bob Marley and U2 and Stevie Winwood and all the others. So she was very pioneering in many ways for many people.
I'm speaking with Heather Augustine, and I remember reading and realizing that before Jimmy Cliff went to Africa, before Bob Marley went to Africa, before Peter Tosh went to Africa, Millie Small, I think, was the first Jamaican artist that I know about that went to Africa. She went there in the 60s. I don't know if it was 64 or 66. Could you talk about some of her international travels and where she took Jamaican music to countries?
Sure. Yeah, and I'm not sure the exact date that she went to Africa. I'm not really familiar with that tour, particular tour, but I do know that when this song became a huge hit in 1964, My Boy Lollipop, Chris Blackwell, you know, wanted to strike while the iron was hot and took her all over the world to promote this song. She went on television shows and radio shows all over the world. She went to Asia. She went to Singapore. She actually lived in Singapore for a couple of years. It's one of her favorite places. She went to Holland. She went all over Europe. She went back to Jamaica for a few days to perform in their independence celebrations and was just given the red carpet treatment, of course, because she had put Jamaica on the map as far as many dignitaries were concerned. And so she really did tour extensively for a number of years, and all the while, Chris Blackwell was right by her side as a father figure. She spoke when I spoke to her earlier this year, she spoke very, very highly of Chris Blackwell. And still, you know, respects him and has a relationship with him. and he was a mentor who really helped to launch her career. So she, you know, then went on to live in Singapore and had a bit of a career in Singapore, but ultimately she made her home in for good in London and still lives there today.
Let me ask you this now. You know, the question of, I think Jamaicans have been, in particular, and black people in general have been branded with the label of being chauvinistic and so on and so forth. Could you talk about the fact Sonia Pottinger and the women, not just the artists, but the role that women play in, you know, like owning labels and behind the scenes, you know, we need to, I think people need to know that they did have women running labels. And I think we had VJ
right,
Records in the United States. You had VJ Records, which was, you know, a black woman had something to do with that. And, you know, it's the same thing. Could you definitely elaborate on that point?
Of course, yes. And thanks for bringing that up, because people kind of forget about Sonia Pottinger. They talk about the kind of the, you know, Cox and Dodd and Duke Reed and Prince Buster. And, you know, certainly it was largely a man's world in these days. But in 1965, a little bit after those guys, Sonia Pottinger recorded her first song for a label that she owned with her husband, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute, but she recorded a song called Every Night by Joe White and Chuck Josephs, and it really was a big kickoff for the label. Actually, that was her first solo song. Prior to that, the label that she had was owned by her and her husband, who was Lyndon O. Pottinger. They had owned the record label together, but then they parted ways in the mid-60s. She had a family to support. She had children. And so she literally took over and took sole ownership of the record label to support her family. There were a number of different labels that she recorded on, her own labels being Gay Feet, Excel, Pep, High Note. Later she had one called Glory, which released gospel titles. But it was her label. And so it was really her career, and she did this for her family. So I thought it was very interesting. Now, she went on to record huge recording artists like Culture. She recorded U-Roy.
Culture, pardon me. Culture, when the 2-7s clashed, that was their big hit, right?
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm, okay,
and,
I didn't want to cut you, I'm sorry.
And she recorded, no, please do. She recorded female artists too, like Phyllis Dillon and Carlene Davis and Sonia Spence and Lorna Bennett and Patsy Todd, the Ethiopians, the Gay Lads, the Melodians, Alton Ellis, Ken Booth, the names go on and on. She was huge. Now, what I found interesting was when I went to research her by going through the Daily Gleaner archives, which is the newspaper of Kingston during this time, there were no articles mentioning her role as a female record producer. Instead, I found article after article on what she was wearing when she was seen at this party or that party, that she was seen wearing peach chiffon, or a, you know, a blouse with, you know, ribbons around the neck. Nothing on her career, to me, that spoke volumes. And on her desk read a nameplate that read, "Heaven will protect the working girl." And she was really, Sonia Pottinger was really just a heroine, as far as I'm concerned. She died in 2010, but she did receive the Order of Distinction in 2004. So that's really the country's highest honor, and she deserves every bit of it.
Well, let me give you my Jamaican gleaner story. As growing up as a young man, I was always a huge fan of Paul Robeson, and I remember I read that Paul Robeson had been published in the Jamaican Gleaner, and one of my objectives was to be published in the Jamaican Gleaner because I wanted to be like Paul Robeson. So I wrote an article which was published in the Globe and Mail on Johnny Osborne. Now, the Globe and Mail is the biggest newspaper in cannabis, the paper that they read all over the world, and they don't pay that much money,
right.
But they say that, you know, your byline goes all over the world. They read you in Tehran,
right.
And in Turkey and blah, 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 blah. So I write this article on Johnny Osborne,
wow.
And I send it to the Jamaican Gleaner, and they run the article with no byline.
Oh!
I was laughing because... a good friend of mine by the name of Keith Ellis, he was laughing. He was saying, "Well, you know, don't be too upset because of, you know, the Jamaican Gleaner, that's the colonial paper, you know." And I kind of felt a little bit better because, you know, that was
right.
A paper that enslaved Jamaica, and it's always been a conservative paper, right?
Right.
But that's my Jamaican Gleaner story.
Absolutely. I mean, they didn't even mention the word ska until it had existed for a couple of years because that's the downtown music. So I understand what you're saying.
They didn't mention. They denied the fact that was the type of music. I guess they were mimicking classical music and music from America. Even
right.
the jazz was supposed to be, since I guess it was coming from America, it was supposed to be better than what was taking place with the little quote unquote ska music, right?
Yes. That's right. Ska was downtown and jazz was uptown.
Mm-hmm.
And there definitely was a class divide, yes, in those days.
Now, how has this book been received?
I'm
sorry, I cut you off.
No, it's okay. I was just going to say that ska wasn't even, that jazz was what was played in the high-class clubs where all the barristers and the doctors came to wine and dine. But ska was downtown music that was played in the Kingston studios and in the hills, and there definitely was a class divide, and I think that the newspaper reflected that.
Right. Now, the songbooks pioneering women in Jamaican music, who published it, and how has it been doing in terms of reviews, and where, you know, how is it, just how is it doing in terms of from a North American, from a Caribbean, and from an African point of view?
Well, that's a good question. First of all, who published it? I have three previous books that were published by academic presses, and although that's been a good way to get into, you know, libraries and kind of the canon, it wasn't affordable for people to really buy on their own. They were more textbook prices. And so this one I decided to publish through Amazon so that it would be more affordable. And so Amazon has published this one. And how has that gone? It's a little bit of what I would call a slow burn. It's not been gangbusters by any means. I kind of thought that there really aren't any other books like this that I can see. There are over 500 books on Bob Marley, but there aren't really any on these women other than a mention here or there in a chapter. So I'm kind of hoping that maybe as more people hear about it, it will make its way onto personal library shelves and library shelves in academic institutions, because like I said, I just don't think there's really anything on these women. And if these women were alive, I found them and talked to them and got the story, because I'm all about primary sources. I tried to go straight to the horse's mouth and get the story from the women themselves, like, you know, Althea and Donna and Patsy Todd and Millie Small, and the list goes on and on. I tried to go straight to them. If I couldn't, if they were no longer alive, I tried to find a relative, like in the case of Hortense Ellis, I found her daughter, one of her daughters, her nephew, people who had worked with them as musicians. So I did the research myself, too, in archives, and found some exclusive photos as well. So I hope that, as, you know, word gets around that there is a book like this available, that people will pick it up, because I do think that nothing else celebrates these women, and it's about time that they were celebrated.
We only have about 2 or 3 minutes left, but another thing about the women independence, you know, I really don't think that the I3s, Judy Mowat, Marcia Griffiths, and Rita Marley have got their due respect, because all of them have recorded their own, I mean, they produced and recorded their own albums. So could you talk about that briefly?
Right. Sure, yeah, absolutely. Maybe it's because I'm a woman myself. I'm also a mother. I have two boys. That the way that I looked at these women was, I didn't look at just their musical output. I also looked at how hard it was for them to maintain the career that they did, aside from the climate. When I talked to Marcia Griffiths, and she told me about having her first son or child, I can't remember if it was a boy or a girl off the top of my head, but at the same time that she is getting ready to go on tour with Bob Marley, I thought, how could she balance that? I can barely make it out to get my mail on some days. You know, how could she go on tour with Bob Marley? And she told me about how she brought her child in a basket on the tour bus, and that the child was, you know, basically, you know, raised by everybody on the tour bus, and it was a family. And to me, that's where, you know, I give my real admiration of these women. For being able to balance everything in their life. We listen to their songs and we hear their voices and we think, wow, they're fantastic. But when you look at them as a human being and everything that they had to do, that's really where I put them on a pedestal.
All right, is there anything else you would like to add? We only have a minute or so.
Well, I mean, if you just, you know, if you'd like to find out a little bit more about my book, you can go on to Amazon.com. I also have a blog that is on my webpage, which is skabook.com, and I blog once a week every Friday. I've been doing it for about a year and a half now. It's called Foundation Ska. I find some obscure or maybe not so obscure part of Jamaican musical history and talk about it.
All right, and it's an honor to have had you on the show, and an honor you did the last show of 2014. And,
wow, thank you.
We made a little history today, and I hope I have read, I've been reading at the book, but as you see, I think I pulled out some jewels for you to talk about.
Yes, yeah, and any one of these women, that's a jewel, all right. So thank you, and I hope that everybody has a wonderful and successful 2015.
And thank you very much. And you have been listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. I would like to thank Lisa Watson for teching, and all the best. This is it for 2014, and we are looking forward to 2015, and we will definitely be black next Sunday, and for a brand new year, and we will see you in the whirlwind. Take care of yourself.